daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Visiting Phnom Penh, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi says China is ready to work with Cambodia to strengthen cooperation in building a bilateral community with a shared future. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $95 billion legislative package providing security assistance to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. China responds to Western accusations of new industry overcapacity. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi says China is ready to work with Cambodia to strengthen cooperation in building a bilateral community with a shared future. Wang Yi met his Cambodian counterpart and called on the two nations to promote people-to-people exchanges and jointly combat illegal activities such as online gambling and telecommunication fraud. Sok Chanda Sophie said Cambodia adheres to the One China policy and welcomes more Chinese companies to invest in the country. Wang Yi also met with King Norodom Sihamoni and expressed China's willingness to work closely with Cambodia to achieve common development and keep the construction of China-Cambodia community with a shared future at the forefront of the times. The king said he believes a friendship between the two countries will be passed down and grow stronger over time. Sokina Aluwalia has more from Phnom Penh.
Minister Wang Yi highlighted the projects that both countries are working on, such as the Industrial Development Corridor and the Fish and Rice Corridor. He said these projects are expected to accelerate Cambodia's economic growth, putting the country into the regional and global landscape. The topics of energy and security was heavily discussed as well, because Cambodia is keen on transitioning into clean and green energy, and China has the technology for that. Another important discussion was how the country will work closely together to enhance cultural bonds. They both agree that strengthening the relationship of their people is also very important. This means they will have more cultural events in the future and promote tourism even more.
Sokina Aluwalia with the report. Now for more, we're joined by Rong Ying, Senior Research Fellow at the China Institute of International Studies. Thank you, Dr. Rong. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you again.
Now, Dr. Rong Ying, the new government in Cambodia has just started their office. How do you evaluate the current level of relations between China and Cambodia?
Well, I would say that the relationship has been excellent, has been good, has been comprehensive, and it has been the result of the sort of a successful transition, not only the government, but also I think the traditional friendship, close relationship, partnership that's being carried forward and further developed and deepened. So I think one telling example is the sort of a frequency and the closeness of the high-level interactions. Remember the new prime minister has been, I think, visiting China since he took over, at least, occasions, three times. Yeah, last September was the first visit, official visit. Last October, he came to China again for the BRI meetings. And then I think last December, that was, of course, for Lantau Mekong cooperation. That other bilateral meeting on the sidelines of regional sort of occasion. So at the political level, I mean, trust is being built up and practical cooperation. This visit is certainly important in terms of formulating and sort of following up the concrete, specific, practical steps to further and deepen the relationship.
The two foreign ministers touched upon a wide variety of issues, but for this year, what might be some of the priorities for China-Cambodia relations?
The priority issues, priority sort of areas for cooperation is to follow up, to implement the sort of action plan for the two countries to building a community of shared future.
Mm.
And as we know, Cambodia is the first country that signed with, signed with China for that action plan to implement that vision of the community future, a shared future. So this is the first meeting for the new government. And at the meeting, the two leaders, the two ministers, not only, I think, took stock of what had happened, but more importantly, I think they formulate and concrete steps how to implement the action, the initiative.
Mm-hmm.
By strengthening synergy, better synergized, but more importantly, I think the initiative that has been working on, like the industrial development corridor, fish and rice, and also I think efforts have been made for the two sides to look for the possibilities of a new project, for example, the railways, and also in terms of agricultural production, agricultural demonstration centers and others. And last but not least, I think the people-to-people exchanges also one of the priority, because this year has been designated P2P and cultural exchange year for the relationship.
Mm.
So lots of specific and concrete things.
Indeed. Well, during the meeting, Wang Yi also mentioned that the two sides should jointly promote the high-quality development of China-ASEAN relations, advance, as you have already mentioned, Lanzhang-Mekong cooperation, and firmly steer East Asian cooperation in the right direction. Now, Dr. Rong, what are the current issues that China and Cambodia can work on together within the China-ASEAN mechanism?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think China and ASEAN, again, they have a vision to building a closer community of shared future based on the initiative, so-called five sort of homes, peace, development, and the other areas. And China and Cambodia bilateral cooperation has always been play a role of demonstration, showing case the sort of possibilities and the potential of that cooperation. And specifically, I think because of the effect of that demonstration, I think the China and the ASEAN relationship has been given kind of a direction.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think the room for imagination in terms of how China and ASEAN can work together in terms of promoting industrialization, also in terms of areas of energy, transition, green and clean energy development. Last but not least, in areas like the security,
mm-hmm.
There are also, I think, the really bilateral relationship between China and ASEAN can play a role. But in terms, specifically at this moment, I think on the question of South China Sea,
mm-hmm.
what is the right way? And what would be, I think, good for the region as a whole, and it's really China that open cooperation, inclusive cooperation, will make a huge difference in terms of promoting centrality of ASEAN, and thus, the importance of peace and stability and prosperity ASEAN has been enjoying as a whole.
Mm. Well, indeed. Earlier, Dr. Rong Ying, Wang Yi visited Papua New Guinea. The country was the first Pacific Island country to sign the Memorandum of Understanding and Cooperation Plan on the Belt and Road Cooperation. And the country has become China's largest trading partner, investment destination, and project contracting market in the Pacific Island, among the Pacific Island nations. Dr. Rong Ying, what experiences could this bilateral relationship provide for the development of China's relations with Pacific Island nations in general?
Yeah, again, I think China and Papua New Guinea, PNG, has the relationship has been, I think, the sound relationship, the sort of has demonstrated in a way that Chinese thinking, Chinese sort of approach for cooperation between China and the Pacific Island states is not only practical, but more importantly, I think, help the region as a whole to achieve its development in line with its conditions. And I think during the visit, Wang Yi made it very clear by emphasizing that China's sort of the very purpose of China's cooperation relationship with Pacific Island states is meant to help them to achieve their development in line with their own conditions. And that way, the approach that China adopts is not meant to impose their vision or their approach that. And more importantly, it does not have sort of political strings or conditions attached, and it always keeps its promise or pledge, not by writing or a kind of blank check. So all in all, China and PNG relationship has very much, in a way, served as a role model between country different sides for mutual respect, mutual consultation, but in the end, for mutual benefit, win-win cooperation.
Indeed, Wang Yi said during the trip that China's assistance to Pacific Island countries has always been free of political conditions and impositions, and China has never issued quote-unquote blank checks. Thank you, Dr. Rong Ying. We appreciate your time and your insight. That was Dr. Rong Ying, Senior Research Fellow at the China Institute of International Studies. Coming up, U.S. House approves $95 billion foreign aid package. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us.
I'm back in Korea.
Home. I love you, Betty.
Love.
Remember?
Thank you.
Bing an.
Fate.
Take care.
What do they truly mean? Embark on a century-long journey with CGTN Radio's latest offering, Echoes of Kulyan, a gripping audio drama series inspired by real-life tales.
Has anyone heard of a Kodashan?
From unexpected encounters to heartfelt reunions, immerse yourself in a narrative of love, peace, and enduring friendship.
He's a piece of my lost childhood.
Listen to Echoes of Kulyan on radio.cgtn.com and all major podcast platforms.
Bing An.
Welcome back to World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $95 billion legislative package providing security assistance to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The vote came over bitter objections from Republican hardliners. The legislation now proceeds to the Democrat majority Senate. The bills include about $60 billion to Ukraine, $26 billion in aid for Israel, and about $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific, including Taiwan. More than 100 Republicans opposed the Ukraine funding, and with only 101 in support. For more details, I earlier talked to Joseph Mahoney, professor of politics and international relations at East China Normal University. Thank you for joining me. Now, Professor, the vote was in favor of aid to Ukraine. Why were the Republicans opposing the bill for a long time before it was passed? Some of them, I mean, this 112, are still opposing it.
Well, the main issue here is that quite a number of Republicans don't want to support that war anymore, including the hardliners in the Republican caucus in the House, who brought down two previous Republican House speakers over this very issue. And of course, we already have some of those current some of those hardliners saying that the speaker who was from their ranks has betrayed his own faction by letting the vote come to the floor. What's interesting, of course, is that the current speaker is an evangelical Christian who insists on giving as much funding to Israel as possible, given his theological conviction that a Jewish government must rule in Jerusalem before Christians can realize the second coming of Christ, according to their interpretation of scriptures. And so this linkage that's happened between Ukraine and the Israeli conflicts forced him into a situation where if he wanted to really achieve his objectives for Israel and have democratic support for that, he would have to go along with the Democrats, including the president, who were insistent on more money for Ukraine.
Mm. We're talking about this this new bill for Ukraine. I mean, how do you think it might affect the war with Russia?
I don't think it will affect the outcome of the war. I think the outcome is more or less settled and has been settled for the most part since December 2022. What it does is ensure that the war simply continues. There's no way that the Biden administration wants to allow the negotiation of peace before the election in November, because he's invested so much of his political capital in this conflict. Who knows what the U.S. may do after, whether he's elected or not. Certainly the indication that Trump may take a very different direction. But I don't think anyone believes that this is going to be a game changer. Merely, it just throws more fuel on the fire and continues to allow Ukraine to limp along in this conflict in ways that are still destroying Ukrainian lives and property, and certainly bearing some costs for Russia as well. But the real victims here will continue to be the Ukrainians, given the intransigence of both Washington and Moscow, given their proxy conflict there.
Mm. Well, then, Professor, are you suggesting that the U.S. has forsaken the support for peaceful negotiations for the war in Ukraine?
That's been explicit. We've heard from leading officials say explicitly that now's not the time to negotiate. What you still hear in some corners of the West is that that this is all a one-sided conflict, that this is entirely a war of aggression on Russia's part, and Russia must be defeated and Ukrainian territory must be returned to Ukraine. Of course, it's not a one-sided conflict. It's a two-sided conflict. It is a proxy war. And what's really unfortunate is that both countries, the U.S. and Russia, have achieved their minimal strategic objectives. And that's one of the reasons why we're not really seeing changes in the conflict, merely just stuck in a holding pattern that's still chewing up Ukraine, not moving towards peace or some sort of endgame.
Mm. Well, the House vote approved assistance to Israel 366-58. On top of that, U.S. has just vetoed Palestine's request for full U.N. membership. Professor, has the U.S. become the outlier in the Israel-Palestine conflict at the moment?
Well, the U.S. is exceptional in its virtually unconditional support for Israel. However, I'm sorry to say that the U.S. is not alone. Quite a number of countries free ride on America's support for Israel, and many have quietly their own arrangements with Tel Aviv, including some Arab and other Muslim countries in the region. Now, I would note here that despite all the hemming and hawing that we've seen from some of these Muslim countries, the Abraham Accords negotiated by the Trump administration are still holding. Furthermore, a large number of European countries likewise lean in Israel's direction. And we're quite excited to shift the discussion away from Gaza to a broader Iran-Israel conflict, which both they and Tel Aviv wanted, and which Tel Aviv managed to effect by violating the Vienna Convention and attacking the Iranian consulate in Syria, which then necessitated a response from Iran, and then which shifted the discourse in Europe and the United States away from the atrocities happening in Gaza towards this larger perceived enemy of Iran.
Mm. But then that doesn't help with the fighting on the ground between Israel and Hamas, right?
No, that fighting continues to be rather tragic.
But U.S. could be more constructive in bringing, peace in this.
Well, there are different narratives. There are people who believe that the Biden administration is very much in line with Israel, even though we hear some criticism now, some direct criticism publicly from the Biden administration against Netanyahu. We do see a lot of hand-wringing and people talking about the need to avoid civilian deaths and ensure that humanitarian aid is getting through. But at the same time, you know, the U.S. and other countries still continue to feed the Israeli war machine and cover over what it's doing in terms of war crimes. And so it persists.
Mm. Well, the package also includes aid to the Indo-Pacific, especially on the Taiwan question. The House approved aid to Taiwan, 385-34, with one member voting present. What signal is U.S. sending out by providing aid for Taiwan?
Well, the most troubling signal is not the aid itself. This is unfortunate, but not unexpected, given U.S. meddling in the Taiwan issue for decades. Rather, I think the bigger problem is that what we're seeing is this new narrative being promoted in Washington that collectively the U.S. must defend Taiwan, Ukraine, and Israel against the mainland, Russia, and Iran, respectively. Now, these linkages have been very explicit in recent weeks, and they serve America's Cold War paradigm and seek to reductively mischaracterize and simultaneously equate all these conflicts as, you know, the old good versus evil model that certainly dominated Western and American discourse, particularly during the Cold War, where the U.S. was described as the evil empire. And then again, during the War on Terror, when the Bush administration described an axis of evil. So I think that this is the direction of the conversation, and that's what's really troubling to me.
Foreign policy of the United States certainly is not only decided by the Congress, it's also decided by the White House too. But looking at this package now, what does the target of this aid package tell us about current U.S. foreign policy priorities?
This aid is significant, but none of them really change things.
Mm.
They're not game changers. They're devastating. They will cause more destruction, but they don't really change things. So I don't think what we're seeing here is a very powerful act by a very powerful country. What we see is someone who's buying time. So I think as we return, as Kissinger said before he died, to this Cold War system, which is still being put in place, it's already normalizing proxy wars with no exit strategies. In other words, I don't think the U.S. is looking for a solution in Ukraine. I don't think they're looking for one in Israel. And they're not looking for one in the conflict between the mainland and Taiwan. It was they want to perpetuate these things because that's what allows the U.S. to work its dark magic of imperialism with divide and conquer. So these, you know, conflicts take place far from the U.S. They end up killing people who are not Americans, while America's strategic goals are met and its military-industrial complex eats more beef and drinks more oil. But, you know, in the age of global warming, which this paradigm unfortunately hastens, we can expect increased insecurity and the greater likelihood of hotter conflicts, and I mean compared to the old Cold War period. Furthermore, you know, China today is bigger and much more powerful vis-a-vis the U.S. than the USSR ever was. China plays a much bigger role in the global economy than the Soviet Union did. So I think that Washington knows realistically at this time that what it's doing won't produce a win. So what it's doing is that it's trying to buy time, hoping that circumstances will shift, maybe, you know, climate change will start to wreak greater havoc in China than other places. And this will create new opportunities down the road for America to perpetuate its power. I think that's unrealistic, but, you know, I think that's what people are praying for in Washington.
Joseph Mahoney, professor of politics and international relations at East China Normal University. Coming up, China responds to Western accusation of green industry overcapacity. For further discussions, follow us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. We'll be right back after a short break.
Wang, chief economist of Hang Seng Bank China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Some U.S. and other Western politicians and media outlets have recently thrown out an opinion attacking China, claiming the issue of so-called overcapacity in China. They focus on the growth of Chinese manufacturing in new industries like electric vehicles, lithium-ion batteries, and solar panels. Chinese Premier Li Qiang offered a detailed response to the claims of overcapacity during his talks with visiting German Chancellor Olaf Scholz recently. Li Qiang stressed that the issue of production capacity should start from economic laws and be viewed objectively from a market viewpoint and a global perspective. He added, China's new energy industry has gained advantages through self-improvement and sufficient market competition rather than government subsidies. So why are some Western politicians hyping the so-called overcapacity issue right now? Does the overcapacity narrative have conflict with global demand for new energy and basic economic principles? For more, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Yan Liang, professor of economics at Willamette University.
So Yan, first, who determines the optimal capacity for an industry? Nicholas Lardy, a senior fellow with Peterson Institute for International Economics, said that the concept of excess capacity is potentially harmful. And he noted that there is no way of measuring the overcapacity and the U.S. suggestion that no country should produce more of a product than could be sold domestically does not make sense. So what do you make of it?
Right. So I agree with Lardy. I think it is a tricky concept. And usually, I think economists would look at, for example, capacity utilization, look at inventory levels, and also looking at, you know, industrial profits and some of the other indicators to gauge what is the level of, you know, capacity in terms of, you know, related to demand. But I don't think this idea that we should measure overcapacity by looking at if the products are consumed domestically or being exported as a gauge, because what that means is if countries all only just produce for their home markets, that would mean there's no trade at all. And I think Lardy gave the example of, for example, Boeing and also the U.S. soybean farmers. So obviously, you know, the Boeing airplanes and also soybeans are not just consumed domestically within the United States, and they're exported out, you know, to the rest of the world. So by this standards, to look at if countries are consuming all what they produce, I think is simply a wrong metrics to look at overcapacity or not. And at the end of the day, you know, China only exports about 20% of its EVs compared to some other countries like Germany, South Korea, Japan. They export anywhere between 80% to 50% to 80% of their home car productions to other countries. So I think by any, you know, indicators, I don't think that China is facing the so-called overcapacity issues, especially in some of the sectors that are mentioned by Jenny Yellen.
Mm. And the so-called overcapacity narrative mainly targets on the EVs, the lithium batteries and solar panels. Actually, those are the new three of China's exports. So could you elaborate more on China's EV and solar panel industries? Actually, what are the main factors behind their rapid development?
Right, precisely. These are the new technologies that are really being you know, produced now in a rapid rate in China, and they're also being consumed domestically, but also exported in some other countries due to the competitiveness of these products. And I think, you know, Janet Yellen and some other economists and media would like us to believe that, you know, China, the reason that China is being so competitive in these sectors or so-called overcapacity in these sectors is because of the government's subsidies. But I think that could not be further from the truth. I think what happened is, yes, countries do have subsidies, and not just China is doing that, but United States, EU, many other countries, or all the countries in the world, have some forms of industrial policies and certain subsidies and public support to their productions. But that doesn't mean that these subsidies or government support can always make an industry or a product globally competitive. So I think for China, this new threes, the success are really owed to a combination of factors. So for one is, yes, there is the government's role that has played a very long-term strategic role in investing in the core technologies in terms of basic research, and also help to, you know, invest in some of the upstream critical mineral roles, and also downstream public infrastructure like charging station. Like China now has 4 million public charging stations, and that really helped to promote the EV adoptions. So yes, the government plays a role, but more importantly, I think China also has established a very solid industrial capacity over the decades, and it has really complete supply chains, over 200 mature supply clusters. And on top of that, China also has really relentless and also very innovative entrepreneurship. One example that I like to mention is, for example, Xiaomi, which is well traditionally known as a cell phone producer, but now it's started to enter the EV market, and its SU7, which is the model that they produce, is sold nearly 90,000 units for the first 24 hours when the product was launched. So this is really innovative and very competitive product, and also very price competitive in the market. So that, I think, is very helpful for its success. And finally, I think we also should not ignore the economies of scale, that the fact that China is a very large market, and the fact that the consumer preferences are in favor of these new green energies and new green products. Mm. So I think all of these factors contribute to the success of the Chinese new technology and new products.
And you mentioned the U.S. government has also, you know, offered subsidies to stimulate the EV sales in the country, and Europe also does that. So could you elaborate more on that?
Right. So in the United States, you know, as we know, in the very recent years, it has passed three industrial policies, like the Inflation Reduction Act, like the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, and also like the Chips and Science Act. And all these, you know, industrial policies are to support various industries, including the EVs, and semiconductors and so on. And I personally have purchased an Tesla EV, and I got $7,500 of the federal money to subsidize on this car purchase, and also another $3,000 from the state subsidy. So it's clear that countries are doing this to support their considered as, you know, strategic and technological advanced industries. So I think, you know, for the United States to say that China is subsidizing and therefore has this sort of, undue, right, competitiveness, I think that is simply double standards, right? They're doing exactly what they accuse China of doing. And I think EU is the same thing. They also have subsidies on the production side and also on the consumer adoption end.
And what's the current situation of the global market demands for those EVs and solar panels? Because when critics suggest that China has an so-called overcapacity issue, do they imply that the world has reached its quota for EVs? But it is far from it, right?
Absolutely. When you look at the International Energy Agency, they have forecasted the global demand for EV is going to reach 45 million units by 2030, which is 4.5 times the figure from 2022. And when you look at the PV, the solar panel, the solar energy capacity, the global demand for the newly installed PV capacity is going to reach 820 gigawatts by 2030, which is about four times the level of 2022. So in other words, there is a huge demand globally for these, you know, green energies and green products. And especially, I think, for developing countries, they're looking for, you know, just energy transitions. They need some of these price, you know, competitiveness, but also high quality EVs and also, you know, PV, the solar panels that would help them to have a, economically effective way to transition into the green economy. So I think the demand is very large out there. The problem is there are definitely politically motivated limitations on certain, products from other countries. So I think that is the problem when you have these barriers to trade. When you artificially limit some of this demand, this is not going to be good for countries to, or for the entire world, to try to decarbonize and try to move towards the more green and sustainable economy.
Mm. So, Yan, so how to treat those protectionist measures today? And what's its impact on the long-term development of countries involved, the U.S., the European Union, and China?
Right, I think that's a great question. I think, you know, China is not really into the sort of tit for tat measure at this point. I think what, you know, all countries should do is really trying to find effective ways to transition, like I said, to the green economy. And I think these kinds of protectionist policies is going to be really counterproductive. I think I'm not too worried about the so-called subsidy race. I think it's really important to provide public support for this kind of energy transitions. But I think protectionist policies like tariff hikes or quota or many other kinds of protectionist policy could be really counterproductive because it's not going to be conducive for the global competitiveness and the global efficiency to move on to the green economy.
Yan Liang, professor of economics at Willamette University. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
39.1 degrees Celsius. Don't worry. You'll be just fine after a shot and some pills.
When we have a high fever, we should go see a doctor for medical treatment. When Mother Earth is running a high fever,
extensively on the heat waves that have hit large areas.
Just like us, she reaches out for help. What can we do to make her feel better?
Hey, I brought my own water bottle.
I brought a reusable bag.
Bring your own water bottle in place of disposable tableware. Don't use a plastic bag.
It's too hot. Let's get a car.
No, we can get there in just 10 minutes by bike.
Walk or ride a bicycle instead of driving for short distances.
Oh, wow. Is your phone broken? Why don't you get a new one?
It's okay. I'll get it fixed and can still use it.
Repair items whenever possible, instead of replacing them with new ones.
Don't bother printing out the meeting proposal. I've set up a shared online document for it.
Build a paper-free working environment instead of printing everything out.
The era of global warming has ended.
Effects from global warming are occurring much more frequently than in the past.
The era of global boiling has arrived.
Mother Earth has a fever, and we cannot withstand the consequences. Take prompt actions to reduce, reuse, and recycle.
Welcome back to World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The International Monetary Fund has warned in a recent report that huge U.S. fiscal deficits have pumped up inflation and posed, quote-unquote, significant risk to the global economy. The IMF's most recent benchmark fiscal monitor showed that fiscal deficit in the United States is projected to reach 7.1% of its GDP next year, while the average level for other advanced economies is only 2%. The report said massive spending by the U.S. could have profound implications for the global economy and poses risks to other countries. It urged the U.S. to address its serious imbalance between spending and revenue. For more, we're joined by Professor Qu Qiang, fellow of the Belt and Road Research Center at Minzu University of China. Thank you, Professor Qu, for joining us again.
Thank you.
Now, first up, how alarming is this? 7.1% of its GDP next year. That's pretty soon.
Yes, it's going to be very dangerous. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine if any other major economy has hidden such a, you know, alarming line of the deficit, what the country would be. I think the only country that can afford that kind of a high level of deficit is America, because they have the power to issue more of the money, you know, to offset their problems. Just take a look. Generally, for the developed economy, our average deficit ratio is probably about 2%. At 3% is alarming enough.
Mm.
So no country would like to go beyond that line and try all of their best to, you know, control their deficit. But America is like two times of that. How large is that deficit? It's like, national borrowing is about $34 trillion U.S. dollar. You probably wouldn't have an idea how large is that. But considering, you know, China's GDP is like 70% of the United States size. But China's, you know, national debt is only $9 trillion U.S. dollars. So which is, you know, U.S. government debt is like four times, it's more than six times of China's national debt. And also another issue is that like Japan, well, it's in a far less economy than China. And also their deficit is also very, very large, getting very close to United States and probably like half size of the United States. So this major economy has hitting the very high line of the national borrowing. So that can be quite a problem. Mm-hmm. So I still remembered ever since 2014, how many times we've been commenting on, you know, the government stopping in the United States. So the Congress and the Parliament and or the Senate are also debating against each other how we can continue with the operation of the government because the debt is skyrocketing, you know, off the roof.
Indeed. Professor, help us understand, you know, how other economies might be affected by, you know, this skyrocketing U.S. deficit.
Well, America have a very large privilege is that they are the international reserve currency, which means they can print the money and buy the other people's products and services. Mm-hmm. You know, you and me, we have to work for all day to produce all kinds of the products and services. But when the United States government, you know, starts the printing machine and they can use the paper notes to buy our services around the world. Mm-hmm. You see, the debt is something you borrowed, you know, in two ways. You borrow from the future, you borrow from the other countries or other people, or you borrow from the other country or other people's future. So either way, when you start borrowing and then you start to repay your debt by printing more of the paper note, basically you're squeezing out the future effective demand. So you're probably going to lead to, you know, on one hand, in major economy, they're going to be potential deflation. But in some weak and vulnerable economy, they're going to be huge inflation, which we have already observed right now. It's been causing chaotic problems all over the world.
Well, Professor, we have about 2 minutes and a half to wrap up the conversation. But the fiscal monitor by IMF also cautioned China should bring down its government debt level too. How would you see this issue?
Well, I think China does have a issue right now, but I think China is defusing it. And I think China is halfway done with the problem. I think domestic debt is not quite a debt according to the basic economics. So China right now has been providing a lot of the packages and the guidance of the policies to defuse the bomb in the property market and the local government debt. And we have seen a lot of progress have been made. Actually, another thing has been worrying me is that actually we should go slower because going too fast, probably going to jump to the other side of the problem. And China is doing very well in defusing the bombs. So I think right now, actually, it's the time to slow the things a little bit and to see what's going to happen next, because the whole world is going to experience a lot of the turbulence. So we do not want to see more of the uncertainties inside of China, and which will cause to, you know, more of the uncertainties around the world economy as well.
Briefly, Professor, the report also mentioned UK and also UK. I mean, how will that have an impact on other European economies and perhaps, you know, in other economies around the world?
Yes, in short, UK sterling pound is not the currency of its own alone, but also sterling pound is providing the liquidities in many financial markets. So if UK economy started to be dysfunctioning, and I think major problems will also happen in the European financial market. And a spillover effect will also, you know, give very negative impact towards the world economy as well.
That sounds a worrying situation, especially the spending by the U.S. government. Thank you, Professor. We appreciate your time and your insight. That was Professor Qu Qiang, fellow of the Belt and Road Research Center at Minzu University of China. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
As one of CGTN Radio's most popular programs, World Today provides listeners with a strong mix of international news and business. It delivers in-depth analysis of current affairs and one-on-one interviews, bringing you the stories behind the news, not just what's happening, but why.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Voters at several polling places in a northeastern Indian state are heading back to the polls after violence disrupted the vote on Friday. Election authorities voided the results at 11 Manipur state polling stations after armed men damaged voting machines. Friday marked the first day of India's election, as Prime Minister Narendra Modi seeks a third term. The voting process will last several weeks, and the results are expected in June. For more details, my colleague Zhao Ying joins us in the studio. Thank you, Zhao Ying.
Thanks for having me.
Now, could you please bring us more on the attacks in Manipur last Friday? I mean, what underlying tensions may have contributed to the outbreak of violence?
Well, Manipur has been largely divided by ethnic violence between the state's two dominant ethnic groups, the Hindu-majority Midas and the Christian hill tribes known as Kukis. Mm-hmm. So their conflict began last May and has lasted for months, almost a year actually. And it arose from a dispute over who gets to claim a special tribal status that grants extra privileges. And during this conflict, over 200 lives have been lost, including members of both groups. Thousands were displaced and still fear to return to their homes, and they're living in dire conditions in makeshift camps. And the recent attacks during the elections saw armed men storming polling stations, and video footage shows they were capturing voting booths and even firing upon voters, despite the presence of the paramilitary forces. The Election Commission of India has ordered a revote in 11 polling stations, as you just now said, but members of opposition political groups say the problems extend far beyond, and they are calling for a new voting in actually more than 45 polling places in 12 areas in Manipur.
Mm. Well, this is only the start of the votes, but Zhao Ying, how significant is this election, and what are the main issues?
Well, it is significant not just in terms of scale, but also in its implications for the nation's future, because, you know, first of all, the country has over 960 million eligible voters, and that's more than 10% of the world's population, and they represent the largest electorate anywhere and will include 18 million first-time voters. Mm. And they will decide the political direction of the world's most populous nation, not just as domestic politics, but also foreign policies for the next 5 years. And now when it comes to the big issues, one of the key themes is of course, the economy. With India's growing population and its aspirations for global leadership, ensuring economic stability and growth is top of mind of many voters. And the election could be seen as a referendum on Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The main focus of Modi's BJP is what they call the Modi Key Guarantee. It is basically a campaign pledging economic development, infrastructure building, and families lifted out of poverty because, you know, while the country's economy is growing, much of that wealth remains concentrated at the very top, and the gap between the rich and poor is actually widening. And besides, the unemployment rate, especially among young people, is pretty high, and there's just not enough jobs for the young people, which could be an issue of that the opposition will try to capitalize on. And also, India is a diverse tapestry of cultures, religions, and languages, and addressing the needs and aspirations of every community is a crucial yet difficult task. And one of the most hotly debated topics is identity and nationalism, because Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been pushing towards a more assertive form of Indian nationalism, and is often tied to the promotion of Hindu culture and values. And this has sparked debates about the role of religion in politics and the rights of those minority communities. But also, I think it's important to keep an eye on India's foreign policy, because over the past several years, India under Modi has been moving closer to the U.S., which wants India to be its ally against China. But in the meantime, I think India has been very careful in this relationship, because obviously it has different priorities in the region as with the United States. And also, it still has this non-alignment policy. So I think it's important to keep an eye on its foreign policy, as it may affect the geopolitical dynamics of the region.
Well, Zhao Ying, apart from Modi, who are the other main candidates in this election?
Yes, actually, of course, Modi is at the forefront, and he is seeking a third term. And he has his party, the BJP, holds a strong majority in the parliament because in the 2019 election, the BJP won 303 seats in a 543-seat parliament, and along with his coalition partners, enjoyed a majority of 352 seats. But the main challenges come from a coalition of political parties headed by the Indian National Congress, which is the biggest opposition party. The party previously ruled India for decades, but it lost the previous two national elections and is no longer seen by many as a viable alternative. So in an effort to oust the BJP, the Indian National Congress, along with other two dozens of other parties, formed the Indian National Development Inclusive Alliance. But the problem is with this coalition alliance is that they are struggling to pitch a cohesive ideological alternative beyond a criticism of Modi. And they have disputes over leadership and seat sharing. And they have also not yet put forward their prime ministerial candidate. So, and also actually recent opinion polls suggest the BJP and its allies are very likely to win the election again.
Zhaoying, in about a minute, I mean, explain to us, how does the election work? Why does it take so long?
Well, first of all, India follows a parliamentary system of governance where citizens vote for members of the Lok Sabha, which is the lower house of parliament. And the party or coalition that secures a majority of the 543 seats in the parliament gets to form the government and appoint the prime minister. And as to why it takes so long, it is mainly due to the country's vast geography and large population, because India's laws actually state that voters cannot be required to travel more than 2 kilometers from their home to get to a polling station. So ensuring access to polling stations takes time. And also there are security concerns because to ensure the safety and security of voters, extensive security arrangements are put in place. And this also takes time. So instead of holding one massive voting day, India opts for a phased approach with different regions voting on different dates, and there will be 7 phases in total, which means 7 polling days. And after voting is completed on June the 1st, results will be tallied on June the 4th and announced by the end of that day.
Sounds a lot of work, but thank you, Zhaoying, for providing us with so much detail. Well, that was my colleague Zhaoying on the Indian election. That's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. For more discussions, follow us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.